From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Life goes on in the shadows of tanks and soldiers, within the confines of checkpoints and curfews. Life continues on the West Bank, when school is in session, when the markets are open, when families and friends can leave their homes to gather for morning coffee or an afternoon meal. Life goes on because it has to. For more than 100 days now, in response to a wave of deadly suicide bombings, Palestinian cities and towns have been under an extraordinary Israeli security crackdown. In some Palestinian towns, people are permitted 4 hours out of their homes every 10 days to buy food. Breaking curfew means risking death. While the world watches and waits for the next movement toward or away from peace in the Middle East, people on both sides of the conflict adapt, find new ways to do old chores, get used to the routine of not having a routine. Tonight, we hear voices from Ramallah on the West Bank, everyday people for whom life has become anything but everyday. Riham Barghouti, a 30-year-old single woman living in Ramallah, working at Birzeit University, remembering an American childhood and trying to forge a West Bank adulthood. And Salma Halidi, a 41-year-old mother of two teenagers, a special needs teacher at a Quaker school in Ramallah. Later, we'll hear from you. Does hearing about the realities of the Middle East conflict change your view of the conflict or galvanize your position? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I spoke earlier with Riham Barghouti and Salma Halidi in Ramallah. I asked them to describe how their lives have changed in the 100-plus days since the crackdown began in June. Salma Halidi.
Well, I think really the situation has been, for the past year and a half, at different times it's been more difficult depending on the situation. Life has been pretty much stopped, and we have to figure out new ways to live, actually. It's everything that you do, from waking up in the morning, whether you're going to get to work, whether you're going to eat something specific because you can get to the market or not, whether you're going to have school, whether you're going to meet a friend, any type of decision that people make normally on a daily basis, any type of routine has totally been abolished. There's no such thing. You never know the next day what you're going to do. You don't know how your day is going to go. And so it has pretty much stopped any type of normal life a person can have.
So routine.
You wake up every morning and you see if there's closures or if there's a curfew, if they're on the Surda Ramallah Birzeit Road, if they're not there. And it's really by word of mouth that you know during the day how you're going to plan your day.
So routine has really gone away. Salma Halidi, talk to us about the constraints that the security regimen imposes. I mean, exactly what it is. Do you have more checkpoints? Do you have fewer hours to be out of the house? Exactly how does it appear to you as a Palestinian going about your everyday life?
Well, it's really very difficult. I wake up in the morning listening to the cars. If I listen to cars, then the curfew is lifted. I mean, it's life is completely far away from being normal. Sometimes it's 11:30 midnight. We get phone calls from people telling us that tomorrow there's going to be a complete curfew. So nothing is everything has changed. Our kids, their life, the way they go when they go to school. They're going to study, whether they have a normal school day, whether they're going to be able to go actually to reach school the next day is something quite unpredictable.
Salma Halidi, exactly how does the curfew work? When the curfew is on,
yes.
How is it imposed? What does it require?
Usually, at some point throughout the several months before, it was complete curfew, and it was only lifted depending on the incursion, how long it took. What happened is that it was lifted for maybe 4 hours every 4 or 5 days. Nowadays, sometimes they lift it 7 o'clock in the morning till 6 o'clock in the evening. So we have to function in those couple of hours, run around, try to manage our lives, try to go to school, to work, if there's work, of course. For many people, work doesn't exist anymore. And people, we're so much under stress.
And Riham Barghouti, when the curfew is in effect, What does it mean? Are there suddenly soldiers in the streets, or are they always there, but they allow people to come and go when there's no curfew, and when there is a curfew, they chase people back in the house or ask them to go back in the house? How exactly is it? Does it work?
It really depends on the military orders at any specific time. During last April, for example, there was a total curfew. The Israeli soldiers were constantly in presence throughout Ramallah, throughout the area. Even when they lifted the curfews, there would be various tanks and stationed in various areas. It would depend on how you would move. There would be hills of dirt put in specific places that would not allow you to enter. You wouldn't be able to drive or walk by these places. During this time, it's much more complicated because of the fact that there's a curfew, but it's not very strictly imposed. And so therefore, people, because they have to, tend to break the curfew. They go out. It's also as a form of struggle and not accepting the fact that we are stuck in our houses every evening after 6 o'clock. The problem is, however, at any point, the Israeli military can crack down. There's tanks present in specific areas, especially around the presidential compound, in specific streets, and you really don't know where and when you are going to come up to an Israeli tank or jeep or when they're going to carry out some specific activity that's going to be very violent. So it's much more dangerous now than it was before.
And when there is a crackdown, Rehan Baghouti, what does that mean?
You know, sometimes they stop cars, they take the keys, they stop the drivers, they may arrest them, they may just detain them for a few hours. They may just take the car and tell them to go and walk away. They may throw the sound bombs or tear gas bombs in specific areas at people that are walking in the street. It depends. There is the thing about the Israeli occupation and the Israeli incursions is the fact that it is so arbitrary, and the fact that there are no laws and there are no rules. There is nothing that you can say is a normal curfew day or an abnormal. Everything is contingent about the Israeli soldier that's present at some specific point. It doesn't seem to be any system or order to it, except for the fact that you feel like they want to constantly break you. It's an attempt to break you. So you think you're free, but you're not. And they constantly prove that over and over again.
Salma Halli, you're a teacher in a Quaker school in Ramallah. Does school go on? Do you have classes? And what's the state of mind of your students?
Well, recently we've had several school days, but they're very abnormal school days in the sense that we started school at the end of August, actually, and now we're almost heading to the middle of October. We've had only 17 full school days. We're quite lucky in Ramallah compared to other cities. Let's say Nablus. Nablus has not had a single normal school day since school started this academic year. Schools, the effect of what those continuous incursions on school children has been drastic. I mean, you can see lots of signs of insecurity with kids. Their state of mind is very distracted. Their attention span is very short. They're very restless. They suffer from headaches and stomach aches. And you're talking about small kids who come to school every day, whenever. I mean, they're sitting there trying to concentrate on their work, and then whenever they hear even something like a door banging, they just jump from their chairs. It's quite a heavy, very, very stressful situation for our children. But people are really, it's a form of struggle that we're trying to do our best, in the sense that carrying on to have normal school days. At some point when the curfew was implemented for a long time, that was last week for almost 2 weeks in a row. Mm. Another alternative was neighborhood schools. People started opening schools in buildings, in a sense that very informal schools, actually. Teachers or parents would provide schooling for kids in their apartments, and this was a form of survival as well. So this is what we're basically trying to do these days.
And Salma, you have your own children, a son who's almost 16, a daughter who's almost 13. Yeah. Them you know very intimately. How do they deal with confinement to the home and the whole environment of tightened security situation?
Yeah, well, we're trying to do our best as far as we're concerned, in the sense that they're trying to find their own way of coping with the situation, meeting with their friends in their neighborhoods as much as possible. We need to survive. We need to find other means of survival. It's very difficult. There's a lot of energy that needs to be for them. There are no outlets for the there's no normal social activities for our kids. It's very difficult, very stressful. And at times you find that whenever incidents take place around, you can see the fear in their eyes or other children's eyes, and you can see how traumatized they've been.
But Salma Khalidi, I wonder what you tell them, especially your nearly 16-year-old son, given everything that's gone on, given the fighting, given the suicide bombings of young men who have sometimes been nearly his age.
Yeah.
How do you advise him to think about this situation?
Our basic survival is to survive as human beings and to live a normal life as much as possible. There's a lot of anger in my kids. We try to advise them. I mean, I don't know how I try to advise them directly in that sense. It's just that I try to make them strong, to cope with the situation as much as possible. It's very difficult.
And Riyan Baghouti, you spent most of your life in the United States. For 8 years, you've been there. Is this the most difficult time you've been through? And what do you think would be most difficult for Americans to understand about the situation?
Actually, I've been here for 8 years. I lived in almost 20 years in the United States, and I think it's just the fact that although the word freedom is so, you know, constantly used in America and in American society, lack of freedom is not really understood. What it means, what it entails, that you are unable to decide even the most basic things, that you are unable to get into your car sometimes and drive for miles and just think. You're not able to go to work and plan a day according to what you think you need to do and according to some type of long-term strategic plan or short-term plan. The fact that you can't decide what you eat because you don't know what's going to be available in the market. I think that, you know, there's a tendency to use this word freedom, but the lack of it, being caged up, literally speaking, being caged up, whether it's in your apartment or in your town or in, a slightly larger area, nonetheless, not being able to decide to travel, to come and go as you please, being unable to make decisions that any normal human being needs to make in order to plan and in order to live their lives, I think that this is the problem, you know, this is the problem that most Americans would never be able to understand this.
Salma Khalidi, let me put to you then, Americans have heard recently from President George Bush that America is unwilling to live with fear. And in some sense, that seems to be what Israel is saying as well. They will reach out and clamp down. They're not willing to live in fear of suicide bombers. Do you understand that? Do you feel ever hostage to the most violent resistors to Israel?
I mean, I find whenever I hear such comments, I feel very angry about them. I mean, I don't think anybody wants to live in fear. It's just that who's the one who's creating the fear, and how can we stop that fear is the question. I mean, how can we even talk about that, and who has the right to say that some people would not allow their people not to live under fear, while it's very normal for a whole population, the whole Palestinians, to be not only we live under practical fear every single minute. We live in a big prison. We live. I agree completely that I can't make the comparison. I feel that our kids are living fear even when they're in their school, even when they're in their streets. We live in daily fear.
Riyan Baghouti, thank you for sharing with us some insight into your day-to-day life there.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And Salma Khalidi, thank you for being with us and opening a window onto your life right now in Ramallah.
Thank you.
I spoke earlier with Riyan Baghouti and Salma Khalidi in the West Bank town of Ramallah. We're discussing life at the eye of the Middle East storm tonight. Listeners, how does hearing about the realities of life on the West Bank impact your thoughts on the conflict? You can call 1-800-423-8255 to join the conversation. That's 1-800-423-8255. 8255. When we get back, we continue the conversation with an Israeli civil rights activist and journalist who will share observations and insights about life on both sides of the West Bank divide. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about life under Israel's West Bank security clampdown, about living the Palestinian life there. Now, you can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Does hearing the gritty facts of life in the West Bank today change your view of the conflict or galvanize your position? Do you hear enough about the difficulty of West Bank life now? Do you hear too much? Join us, 1-800-423-8255. Talk. My guests tonight are Devorah Brous. She is founder of Bustan Ishalom, an Israeli human rights group that works with dispossessed communities in Israel and the West Bank. And Matthew Kallman, joining us from Jerusalem tonight. He's Jerusalem correspondent for London's Daily Mail newspaper and formerly the Jerusalem correspondent for U.S. Today. Good evening, Devorah.
Good evening.
And good evening to you, Matthew Kallman.
Good evening, Tom.
Matthew, thanks so much for being up at this late hour for us. We just heard in the first section of the show, and I think you heard it as well, the thoughts of two West Bank Ramallah residents, Palestinian women, who talked about the day-to-day reality of dealing with the security clampdown. Can you put their comments in perspective for us, Matthew? Remind us what it was that led Israel to take these extraordinary security steps, and describe in your words the reality of that life for Palestinians living under that clampdown.
Well, I think the reality as described by your two guests just now was extremely accurate. It's a reality for Palestinians who live in the West Bank of tanks and troops on the streets, of having their movements confined, daily curfews, almost arbitrary procedures. They never know when they go out of their houses, if there's going to be trouble, if there's going to be violence, if there's going to be troops at the end of the street. It's a very abnormal situation. And it's particularly affecting the children, who are either cooped up in their houses sometimes for days on end, or just don't know where to go, and often seeing violence at first hand in a way that we wouldn't want children anywhere in the world to be seeing. So it's a very, very difficult situation for the Palestinians at the moment. What triggered this was more than a year of violence, which began in September, the end of September 2000, with street demonstrations against Israeli soldiers who then were on the outskirts of the Palestinian cities, not inside them. Mm-hmm. We then saw that grow into military battles and gun battles in the streets, and then waves of suicide bombings taking the violence into the Israeli cities and into the hearts of the Israeli population. And then finally, about a year ago, the Israelis had started moving into the Palestinian cities, and for the last few months they've been there more or less permanently, either carrying out raids, bombing raids sometimes in response to Palestinian suicide attacks, and in the last few months a more or less permanent occupation of almost everywhere in the West Bank. So the Israeli security forces say they're trying to respond to the violence of the Palestinian uprising, but as we can see, they haven't really found a response to that which provides Israel with any more security, because the suicide bombings are still continuing.
Well, let me ask you about that, Matthew Kallman. Has the crackdown, to some degree, or has it not to a considerable degree, worked in security terms?
The honest answer to that is it's very difficult to tell. And the Israel itself is divided on that question. One half of the country says it's better from Israel's point of view to take the fight to the Palestinians and into the places where they are, so that the fight is taking place there instead of inside the Israeli cities, and that by being there, they can police those cities, they can go after suspects, they can destroy bomb-making equipment and terrorism labs, and they can arrest people. The other half of Israeli public opinion says that this is only exacerbating the situation, and that for every Palestinian that they capture or arrest or kill, that merely creates 10 more who want to bring the fight back into Israel's cities.
Matthew Kallman, stand by. Devorah Brous here with me in the studio. You and your group work with people on both sides of this line, with Israelis, with Palestinians, inside Israel, in the West Bank. What is your sense of how long this crackdown is sustainable in human terms? Can it go on indefinitely with the curfews, with people confined to their homes for hours and hours or days and days? Or is there some limit at which in human terms it just cannot go on?
I think in human terms, it lost its sustainability a long time ago, and that pretty much the whole point of the military occupation is that it has lost its human terms. It is not sustainable. We cannot go on teaching terrorists or civilians that terror is wrong by terrorizing a population. That is not, as Matthew mentioned earlier, that is not serving as a deterrent for terrorists. That is serving to bring more people to line up outside the doors of the Hamas, the Islamic Jihad, and the Tanzim to get active in serving their aggression against Israel.
You were in Bethlehem in the West Bank a couple of months ago. Give us a sense for how life feels under the crackdown.
Well, essentially, I was there during a time when the siege was fierce, where people were let out of their homes for 3 hours during a period of 10 days, as well as something that was mentioned earlier by Salma. Mm-hmm. There's no sense of normalcy. The children are not allowed to go to school, obviously. People are not in the streets. They're locked into their homes under house arrest. And the children in the home where I was staying had become so well-versed in the sounds of the occupation that they could differentiate between an F-15 and an F-16. They could differentiate
overhead
between the sound of a tank and an armored personnel carrier rolling in the streets past their home.
Matthew Coleman, how exactly does the curfew work? Curfew sometimes seems like an odd word in the United States. We tend to think of that as you must be in by a certain time. But in some of these towns, it means you're in almost all the time. How do Palestinians know when to be in, when to be out, when it's safe, when it's not?
It's a very strange feeling. The way that the curfew works differs from city to city and even from day to day. At the start of the occupation, when the Israelis went back in earlier this year, they would have jeeps patrolling the streets announcing that the curfew was about to be lifted or was about to be imposed. And generally, the curfew would last during the night most of all and would be lifted either for most or part of the day. But what we actually saw in places like Ramallah was that even before the curfew was reimposed, people got so used to the rhythm of the Israeli crackdown that actually they would, if the curfew was reimposed at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, they were already back in their houses by 2 because they didn't want to take any chances that they would be out during the curfew and might get shot. So the Palestinians were adapting very quickly at first to the rhythm of the occupation. But what we see in other places like Nablus, which has been more or less permanent siege and a curfew that hasn't been lifted at all sometimes for weeks on end, that people are cooped up inside their houses. And recently they've actually come out onto the streets to defy the Israelis and to say they won't be cooped up in their homes all the time and they don't want to get used to the rhythm of the occupation.
And what has the response been to that? What has the response been to those demonstrations?
Again, it differs from place to place. In Ramallah, where the curfew began to be broken by Palestinians coming out in the evenings, so long as those demonstrations remained more or less peaceful and people were just sort of coming out and going into the streets and everything, the Israelis seemed to hang back for a while. But it's arbitrary. It depends on which soldier is on which gun, on which tank, and sometimes they would open fire without warning, sometimes they wouldn't. It's completely arbitrary. It's the arbitrariness of this occupation that is one of its most frightening aspects. The people on the streets never know where the next bullet is going to come from.
Listeners, we're talking tonight about life under Israel's West Bank security clampdown, about living the Palestinian life. Now, is curfew and clampdown the best way to deal with the Palestinians today? Is it the only way? Is it pushing toward peace or rage? And does Israel have the luxury of worrying about that? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Malik is on the line. Welcome, Malik. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Good evening.
This is Malik. How are you?
Very well, thanks.
Yeah, I have one comment for the Palestinians first, and then I have a question for the people like who are doing the strategic thinking in both the Palestinian as well as the Israeli side.
Mm-hmm.
History has shown time and again that it's never possible to come to a successful end by returning terror with terror. Why can't somebody in Palestine follow the example of Mohandas Gandhi and use nonviolence to respond to the terror,
mm-hmm.
respond to the basically the police threat that Israel is showing, and I understand that it's going to be very difficult for Israelis to do that thing because in general it's always better, it's always much easier and better to respond nonviolence when on the other end is kind of more organized.
So, Malik, you're recommending to the Palestinians or suggesting, why don't you take the Gandhian path and respond peacefully?
Yeah, exactly. I understand that life must be very difficult
mm-hmm.
these days, to stay inside the house for 10 days and 30 days at a time. So if one day, all of a sudden, all the Palestinians, they just say that, we are not going to sit inside the house. We are going to come outside the house. We are going to do our work, but we are going to do it peacefully.
Malik, let me put it to our guest, and thank you for your call. Devorah, even in Gandhi's time, this was a radical way to go. In this conflict, it seems extremely radical to suggest that some kind of peaceful mass movement might overcome here. Can you imagine that, given the facts on the ground, is the phrase we often hear from Israel and the West Bank, and given the mentality of Palestinians and Israelis after so many years of conflict?
It is a dream of many of the peace activists that something like this will happen. And you can see signs of this happening with the International Solidarity Movement activity promoting nonviolence in the streets of Palestine. You see where this is beginning to take hold, and Palestinians are actually joining the internationals by protesting the Israeli defense forces in nonviolent ways.
But do they really have in their hearts, in their minds, the possibility of peaceful response? We've seen so much violence from both sides, so many deaths.
I think that people's hearts have been crushed. People's minds have been crushed. To imagine getting to a place where tanks will stop rolling forward because people are laying down in mass in front of them is but a distant vision right now. There are many people that are beginning to protest the pressures of the curfew and the closure, and this is beginning to take hold. There are many people who are joining Palestinian harvesters as they go to their olive groves, and this kind of action is nonviolent. It's basically a statement that is very, very powerful, a statement saying, we cannot stand by as you create this economic shutdown and refuse to allow Palestinian farmers to pluck olives from their backyard to mm-hmm. harvest their olive trees. This kind of nonviolent action is very important and provocative and gaining strong support these days.
And Matthew Coleman, whether it's something as radical as Malik's suggestion of a sort of Gandhian protest or some other path, how can you imagine this clampdown eventually being eased? How do you take the lid off without the violence roaring back up?
Well, I've actually attended non-violent seminars that are being taught to Palestinian activists in Ramallah and in the West Bank. I have to say that this is a question that's always asked by visitors brought up in the Western democratic tradition
mm-hmm.
Who say, well, you know, why not follow the example of Gandhi? And Gandhi is mentioned an awful lot. And in the seminar that I attended, you had Hamas people being taught about the example of Gandhi. But the fact is that simply isn't part of the culture here. It's not part of the Israeli culture. It's not part of the Palestinian culture. And all these ideas about nonviolent protest are ideas that tend to be imported from the outside, at the moment the evidence is that there is no mass movement of nonviolent protest among the Palestinians, just as there is no mass movement of nonviolent protest in the current situation among Israelis. What got us into this situation in the first place was a violent confrontation on the Palestinian side and violent military response from the Israeli side when at any stage during the last 2 years, either side could have said, you know what, we're not going to go that way. We're not going to respond to the other side's provocations. But neither side seems ready or has been ready at any stage over the last 2 years to adopt that as any kind of mass policy.
So in your view, Matthew,
examples that we've heard about.
In your view, then, Matthew, how could this be ratcheted down?
To be honest, and I know it's unfashionable to say so, I don't see it being ratcheted down at all without either external imposition by somebody, probably America or Europe, who have an awful lot of influence here as well. And the other way that it could be ratcheted down would be quite simply if one side were to take a strategic policy decision to change the way they want to fight here. Either the Israelis saying, you know what, we're going to withdraw the tanks, we're going to try and establish a defensible border, and we're not going to respond in this military manner, or the Palestinians declaring some kind of unilateral ceasefire. We've seen some movements towards that over the summer, with some Palestinian groups in the mainstream Fatah trying to bring about a ceasefire, but they haven't been able to make that hold for any length of time. And part of the reason for that has been that there's been continuing fighting from the Israeli side. Earlier in the conflict, we had 7 different occasions where the Israelis announced a ceasefire and the Palestinians weren't at the stage where they could go on with it. Every time one side seems to be ready, the other side isn't.
Devorah Browse, what about it? Matthew Kalman says he just doesn't see the possibility of a mass peace movement, that it's not in the nature of this culture.
Okay, let's not talk in terms of mass at this point then. Let's talk in terms of effectiveness. There have been different demonstrations happening very regularly at this point where several thousand Israeli, Jewish, and Arab activists for peace go inside West Bank villages and towns and refugee camps and bring with them flour and rice and water and medicine, and we're tear gassed as a result of it. We're stopped, we're stifled aggressively by the Israeli army, but we continue to go through. These kind of efforts led by Ta'ayush and other coalitions, coalition groups that are in Israel, have been very successful, as well as a tremendous amount of support for a campaign against the policy of demolishing homes. Mm-hmm. Israelis going into Palestinian villages and rebuilding homes that have been demolished. And Bustan is involved with trying to rebuild a clinic, trying to create medical care for an entire population that has been denied access to medical care. So these are nonviolent tactics to try to protest the policies of occupation, protest the policies that are suppressing the Palestinian people from obtaining
liberation. Can you see them mounting collectively into a response that changes the tenor of this conflict?
I can only hope that that is what's going to happen. Right now we're trying to work to deepen the impact of these actions, and that does not necessarily mean gaining much more people that will be actively involved in it at this time. We want to be realistic, and we want to try to concentrate the efforts so they'll have a deeper impact, not necessarily a more glitzy headline.
Meanwhile, the crackdown goes on. We're talking tonight about life under Israel's West Bank security clampdown. It came after waves of suicide bombings. We all saw them. We all read about them. Now there are consequences, and the Palestinians are living with that. Is curfew and clampdown the best way to deal with the Palestinians today? Is it the only way? Is it pushing toward peace or rage? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about life under Israel's West Bank security clampdown. We hear a lot about the politics, about the conflicts of leaders. We hear a lot about settlements, very apropos here, a lot about terrorism. Tonight we're looking at the actual life that's going on now over 100-plus days of security clampdown. We're talking about living that Palestinian life on the West Bank, now on the West Bank, what it means for peace, what it means for conflict. You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. Are the struggles of ordinary people on both sides what matters here? Or is this conflict all about battles among political leaders and armed opponents? Is it useful to put ourselves in the shoes for an evening of a Palestinian mother in the West Bank? Or does that just obscure the realities of power politics of hard-line agendas? You can join us at 1-800-423-TALK. We spoke earlier with two women, Palestinian women, in the West Bank, Ramallah, Salma Khalidi and Riham Parghouti. Both of them gave us their day-to-day experience of living under curfews that sometimes go dawn to dusk and dusk to dawn. I'm joined now by Devorah Brous. She's a founder of Bustan Ishalom. It's an Israeli human rights group that works with dispossessed communities, their words, in Israel and the West Bank. And by Matthew Kalman. He's Jerusalem correspondent for London's Daily Mail newspaper, formerly correspondent there for USA Today. You're welcome to join us as well. Amy's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Amy. You're on the air.
Hi. Hi. I'm making my comments as a Jew. I have a lot of empathy for the Palestinians, and I think that Israel, the party with the most power, can absolutely change what is going on in the Middle East by ending the occupation. It is the one thing that has not been tried, and it acts like this isn't a possibility. But what they're doing now is inhumane and ineffective, and it's too bad that our government in the United States lets Israel get away with this.
Hey, Amy, but can they end the occupation, as you call it, when you have several hundred thousand Israeli settlers living in the West Bank who would feel awfully vulnerable?
Well, I really think that those settlements should be dismantled. Those settlements were being built while the so-called peace process was being pursued. And to me, that's an evidence of bad faith in the peace process. Why is Israel continuing to build, even as we speak, settlements on land that doesn't belong to them? It's because the far right wing wants to take over the West Bank and Gaza because they believe historically that is the land of Israel that belongs to the Jews.
Amy, we take your point and we thank you for it. I want to put it to Matthew Kalman, who's in Jerusalem. Matthew, you hear the view of one American here saying, hey, let's end not just the clampdown, but the entire occupation. And for that matter, let's pull out the settlements. Is there something approaching a realistic possibility of either of those things?
Well, thus far, no Israeli government has been prepared to grasp that particular nettle, even when it seemed to be the obvious thing to do, as the court just said, right in the middle of the peace process. In fact, since the Oslo peace process began in 1993, the number of settlers on the West Bank has doubled from about 100,000 to about 200,000. Mm. And the number of settlements has not increased substantially, but the size of the existing settlements has increased. And bizarrely, that was something that was actually permitted under the Oslo Accords. So looking back, it seems as though there was this gaping hole in the Oslo Accords that allowed the Israeli government to continue building those settlements. And there was the desire on the part of the Israeli government, even while it was negotiating peace with the Palestinians, to continue expanding the settlements because they believed at the time that in most of those areas, those settlements would eventually be absorbed into Israel and the borders would be moved. From the Palestinian point of view, that was never going to happen. They always wanted a return to the 1967 borders, and the Palestinians always expected that Israel would withdraw and that the settlements would disappear. So you had this basic fundamental disagreement over what the future map was going to look like, going right back to 1993. And this is one of the consequences that both sides are having to deal with now. The Israelis don't seem prepared to withdraw to the 1967 boundaries. None of the Israeli governments, even the peace-seeking governments under Barak and Rabin were not prepared to withdraw to the 1967 boundaries. The Palestinians expect them to, and that really lies at the heart of this whole conflict.
There is the gap. John's on the line. Welcome, John. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi. Tom, it seems to me you're asking the right kinds of questions here. Is there an alternative to the occupation? Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that your panel is constitutionally incapable of grappling with that. And the hard part here is that this is a war created by a collection, one portion of the Palestinian society that is committed to romantic violence. And the occupation.
Romantic violence. Hmm.
Yeah. And this occupation that the Israelis have installed has just been remarkably successful at taking the level of homicide bombings down to crudely what it was during the Oslo peace process, although not to the level it was before Oslo. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's what creates the possibility of a better politics in the future.
John, hang on. Stick with us.
Let me be clear with this idea.
Yeah.
What's going on here is a commitment to a kind of medieval politics that we can't tolerate.
I think we've got your perspective, and hang on, because I want to put it to Devorah Rouse while you're here, John. What about it, Devorah? John says, look, practically speaking, we all remember what was going on. There were these bombings. Israelis were dying and freaked out and in fear and afraid to go themselves to the corner store. This, in security terms, is working. What are you going to do about it?
This, from my understanding, is not a past tense equation. This is part of the present understanding. There's a fear in the streets today in Israel. People are afraid to go to the universities. They're afraid to get on their buses. They're afraid to dismantle the occupation, afraid to dismantle the settlements, because they believe that the maximalist Palestinians, which is different from what Matthew was just alluding to, the maximalist Palestinian claims speak of returning to mandatory 48.
Mm-hmm.
They speak about Jaffa, Haifa, Akko. They
to
don't
the
speak about the 67 borders.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, our old paradigm politics of return to 67 seems somewhat antiquated. And I think we have to demand more of ourselves. It's clear that the policies of the occupation do not work. That's very clear. But the arbitrariness...
John's saying they do. He's saying they do. They've reduced suicide bombing level to an earlier, more manageable, not great, but more manageable level.
I think, first of all, it's impossible to chart that and to prove such a fact. And I think, second of all, one thing that we do know is that for every homicidal bomber that is prevented from getting inside the streets of Israel, we don't know how many more have been generated as a result of these policies.
John, let me put Devorah's perspective back to you. Devorah said earlier, this is not sustainable in human terms. That makes it inhumane. And secondly, she says it's just breeding more trouble, new waves of trouble in the future.
All right. I think it's a fair point of view, Tom, but let me just respond cleanly.
Mm-hmm.
It is measurable. We measure these things carefully, and you can read the measurement anytime you like. Human life, the death by suicide bombing is measurable, and that is way down. That's easily measured. Is it sustainable? Yes, of course it's sustainable. Large, carefully run intelligence operations backed up by force usually routinely reduce violence all over the world.
But sustainable in people essentially locked in their homes for as much as 24 hours a day, week after week, month after month, is that sustainable?
Yes, it is sustainable. It's not good, but it's sustainable. The issue is what's good, and what is good is a higher quality and less romantic and less violent politics, and that is not possible until the least attractive parts of Palestinian society come to understand that there must be a different politics besides random, high-quality violence.
John, we've got
That's
it.
That's what we're doing.
We got it. Matthew Kalman, let me put it to you. John is suggesting, and we read Israeli military officers saying the same thing from the West Bank, that there is a lesson being taught here in collective responsibility. Do you see that lesson taking? Do you see Palestinians picking that up? I have to say, I didn't hear it earlier in the comments of the Palestinian women who joined us from Ramallah. Do you see it?
No, I don't see it. With one exception, and that is the town of Jala, from where there was shooting taking place at the nearby neighborhood of Gilo, which is built on disputed land. And we saw shooting across from Gilo to Bet Jala for many, many weeks. And last week, when the gunmen returned to Bet Jala to start shooting again, the residents came out of their homes and actually threw them out.
Mm.
That's a very, very rare case, though. And has more to do with Christian-Muslim relations than the normal situation in the West Bank. The Israeli military and security are trying to teach that lesson, if you like, to the Palestinians. But the Palestinians are not taking that lesson. They're taking a very different lesson from it. The lesson that they take is that these Israelis are brutal occupiers, and the sooner they get out of the Palestinian cities, the better.
But we did see moves in recent weeks to have changes in the Palestinian Authority. This was before the occupation of Yasser Arafat's compound in Ramallah. There were moves to oust some powerful figures in the Palestinian Authority. It looked like a kind of cleanup might be beginning.
Yes, but these moves in the Palestinian Authority have been deeply misunderstood in the West. The forces for democratic change inside the Palestinian Authority are not forces who are calling for some kind of accommodation or capitulation to the Israelis. On the contrary, the forces feeding this call for democracy inside Fatah are people who want to step up the resistance to the Israelis and want to end the occupation even sooner. And they accuse Arafat and his leadership of being corrupt and somehow collaborating with Israelis.
Got it.
So the fact that they are criticizing Arafat doesn't mean that they're suddenly going to turn around and embrace the Israelis.
Robin's calling from Newton, Massachusetts. Hi, Robin. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I'm a first-time caller.
Good to have you.
Thank you. It's an important show. Before I speak about what's on my mind, I just want to say I do not believe at all that this situation has anything to do with the settlements. And as Devorah said, going back to 1967 is an antiquated point of view. I'm very disappointed, Matthew, that you said that. I also don't believe with the previous caller that this occupation is decreasing the violence, and I don't believe this is the answer.
But so what's your question, or where do we go here, Robin?
Well, what I want to say is this, is that I commend both Devorah and Matthew for being able to be self-analytical and self-critical. This is something I really hear from the Palestinian side. What I mostly hear is criticism of the Israelis and the Israeli government. In fact, before the two women that you had on earlier, the two women from Ramallah,
yes.
Unfortunately, I don't feel that they understand that Israelis are also living in their own figurative curfew. They don't know when and I like to refer to the suicide bombers as homicide bombers. This is not suicide. This is homicide. They are killing innocent people. And mothers in Israel never know when a homicide bomber is going to strike. They don't know if their children go to a discotheque or if they go out to lunch, if they're going to be blown to smithereens.
Mm-hmm.
And
Robin, our time is running down, but I think we've got it. You raised this issue of empathy, and if you let me, I want to put it to Devorah. Devorah Browse, you work with both parties, with both sides. You're Jewish yourself, but you've reached out to both sides. Do you agree with Robin that there is some kind of ingrained lack of empathy on the Palestinian side? I did raise this with the two women from Ramallah, and they said, yes, there's problems there too, but they're just not comparable or parallel to what we're facing.
I agree with Robin that it's important to be able to criticize yourself, and that is just not actually happening enough. And we have to be able to move past a place where we're pointing fingers, pointing blame, associating all the blame and responsibility for the on the other side, and not willing to claim any responsibility for our own actions. And I think that that's too commonly what is happening from both sides.
But do you see an empathy deficit on the Palestinian side? You know both sides.
I see an empathy deficit on the Israeli side. I see an empathy deficit on the Palestinian side. I see a problem with people today who choose to be pro-Palestinian, and that necessitates being anti-Israeli.
Mm-hmm.
I see a problem with people who are pro-Israeli, but that necessitates being anti-Palestinian.
Mm-hmm.
And I forget about people that can be strongly anti-war, but can remember that there is a position which will allow you to be pro-Palestine, pro-Israel.
You've been traveling around the United States speaking. Do you hear that in the American community that you're talking to?
Unfortunately, I'm not hearing that echoed enough. I am hearing that it does resonate with people, that it makes sense, that you can be in support of humanizing the people on both sides, the civilians on both sides that are suffering, and be against the policies of the leaders on both sides that are causing the amplification of the terror that people on both sides are feeling. And that means that we have to take real responsibility to work to end the occupation, and we have to take real responsibility to try to eradicate terror from the streets of Palestine and of Israel. There is no need to perpetuate. We have to just work all across the board.
Matthew Cullen, we just have 20 seconds left, but let me ask you, are we being simply naive tonight talking about this at the human level, the day-to-day reality of Palestinian life right now?
I don't think we're being naive at all, Tom. I think what it comes down to is the kind of suffering that ordinary people, ordinary families are going through. That's what's at the heart of this conflict. That's what's at the heart of the fear on both sides that's driving the politics.
We're going to have to come back and look at this from the other side of that greenish line, perhaps from the Israeli side. But it's been great having this conversation tonight. Devorah Browse, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Devorah Browse is founder of Bustan Ishalom. It's an Israeli human rights group that works with dispossessed communities in Israel and the West Bank. And Matthew Cullen, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Matthew Cullen is Jerusalem correspondent for London's Daily Mail. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is W.